made her sad. I never see them without thinking of her, which makes the way I feel about them more complicated, I suppose. Sad, then a little happy, then sad again.
I get that, I say. She gives me an odd look.
Do you?
I think so. She waits for me to go on, so I do. My sister and I had this cartoon we always watched when we were kids, The Busy World of Richard Scarry. We basically only ever watched it while she was too sick to do anything else, so every time I see anything to do with it, that's what I think of. And maybe it's different because she's okay now, but the memories attached to it, I don't know. They're complicated.
Everything's complicated. Everything. Once you start paying attention. My father loved my mother, and he was a shitty husband. He was a horrible father for a couple of years there, right before they split up, but he was a wonderful one for the rest of his life after that. And honestly, even saying those words, shitty, horrible, wonderful, how can that come anywhere close to conveying everything I mean?
You don't have to whittle it down like that, I say. You can take as long as you want, Margaret.
But people stop listening, she says. They want the soundbite. They want the headline. That's what my family built, and now we don't get to stop it from coming for us.
You're a human, I say. The machine can try to compress you into something two-dimensional, digestible, but that's not you. And we're not here to service the machine.
Don't you get it? She says. It won't matter. If we do this book, I go back to being their paper doll. They'll splash the most salacious tidbits across the top of a listicle. And the audience will pass their judgments on all these people who are just characters to them but are real to me, on Cosmo, on my mother and father, on...
She trails off, choked up. My chest cramps. I can't help it. I'm already crossing the boat, taking her hand as I sit. I'm so sorry, I say. And I won't pretend you're not right. The listicles will exist. The headlines will be salacious. But your story will be out there too, the whole thing. You just have to figure out if one is worth the other. She raises her eyes to me.
See? She says. Nothing's ever simple.
I squeeze her hands. We can be done for today if you need.
No.
She pulls her fingers out from between mine.
Not yet. I want to tell you about them. My parents.
I feel myself smiling, feeling both proud of her for opening up and proud of myself for slowly starting to earn her trust. I'd love to hear all of it. But maybe we should go somewhere less buggy? She chortles.
Now that's good thinking.
She starts the boat's fan back up and steers us back the way we came. Something about her posture seems lighter, her shoulders relaxed so that her neck looks long and stately. It makes me happy to think that even if this is hard for her and she's uncertain about what we're doing here, it's unburdening her in some way, to be seen, to be known again, after years of hiding. I'm sitting cross-legged on the living room rug, a hot mug of decaf at my knee, when the first text from an unknown number with a New York area code buzzes in. Hello. Nothing else, just hello. I smile to myself. If I'd been offered $1 million to guess what Hayden Anderson's first text to me would be, I'm reasonably sure I'd be a millionaire now. Hello, I write back.
Who is this? He says.
I snort.
Wow, okay. 6 weeks of fiery passion and you've already forgotten me?
Sorry, I have the wrong number, he says. I take a sip of coffee, then swipe a throw pillow off the couch and flop back onto it. Isn't this Hayden? He starts typing right away, but it takes forever for his reply to come through.
I'm really sorry, but I have no idea who this is.
You texted me. I remind him. Another long pause for typing. I'm just kidding. It's me. I send a follow-up. Alice. And then another. Scott. He writes back, from the scratch? From the tiny island you're currently on, I say. Oh, that Alice, he replies, playing along. Then adds, you really had me scared for a minute. I was looking back through my calendar for a 6-week stretch of fiery passion. I laugh aloud, flip onto my stomach, and push my laptop out of sight. I was typing my notes out from the rest of today's session, and riveting as it was, I'll have all day tomorrow to finish that up. How far back did you go? 6 months, but I only stopped because that's when I got this phone. What are you up to? Not working, I say. What about you? Also not working, he says. A good night for it, I write back. Would you want to do something? He says. He sends me a pinned location for another 24-hour diner in Savannah. Only if you think you can stand not talking about Margaret for a few hours. A few hours? How many courses are we having? I ask. Didn't mean to be presumptuous, he says. I'm kidding, Hayden, I say. I'll be there in half an hour. Great, he says. He is, of course, at the back corner booth of the Atomic Cafe, looking too sharp and clean for his colorfully shabby surroundings. He rises to greet me as I approach, which feels like an exceptionally old-fashioned way of doing things, so I go in for a hug. Immediately, I regret this because he palpably startles at the gesture, but just as quickly, he relaxes, looping his arms around my back.
Good to see you, he says.
His voice a rumble through my bones. He smells like almond, like amaretto drizzled over sponge cake, sweet without being cloying. You smell like dessert, I tell him as we pull apart. He visibly balks, frowning to himself as he slides back onto his bench.
It's Dr. Bronner's.
Wow, I say. Utilitarian yet delicious. His facial expression softens on a laugh. It occurs to me that somehow he thought you smell like dessert was a complaint and not, as I personally suspect, a subconscious and involuntary come on.
Got you coffee,
he says, pushing one of the mugs on the table toward me. Our knees bump. We rearrange so that we're sitting diagonally across from each other rather than straight on. We're not touching, but somehow I can still feel him. He has a presence like that, a magnetic field he carries with him always, but mostly tries to play off as a force field, a barrier to entry rather than an invitation. Thanks. I take the coffee mug between my hands, the heat pleasantly juxtaposing the overzealous roar of the air conditioning. I gesture toward his glass. I'm concerned that your green tea is brown.
My green tea, he says, is sweet tea. Because the Atomic Cafe doesn't have it in that color. At least, that's what the server said.
Did she say it as a full sentence, at least? I ask. Or did she jump right into the middle?
Full sentence, he says. That's one point for them, but Ray's Diner is still winning.
I take a sip of coffee, and I must make a face because he says,
okay, that's one more point deducted right there, clearly.
I look around at the neon turquoise and pink light that lines the windows on the outside of the building and the matching booths inside, the little jukeboxes at every table and the Atomic Age wallpaper slightly curling away from the interior walls. It's got good ambiance, though, I say. Why aren't we at Ray's?
I like to try as many diners as I can when I'm in a new place, he says. Compare them and find the best.
Ah, of course.
Of course,
he says. I shrug. The journalist in you.
The Midwesterner in me,
he counters.
Always looking for the best deal.
I hold up the wide rectangular menu. $6.99 for a steak, eggs, and toast? You can't beat that.
I mean, you could, but you'd probably end up hospitalized,
he says. The server comes by and takes our order. I go with the 2-egg breakfast, and Hayden does the egg white omelet. I'm actually surprised you eat at places like this, I say. His brows pinch together.
Why?
Because even the doorknobs here are buttered, I reply. And you seem to be an exceptionally healthy eater.
Bad habit,
he says. Good habit, if my doctor is to be believed, I argue.
I just mean I was raised that way, he says. Obsessively so. My mom used to be really health anxious, and she was that way with my brother and me when we were little. Just really cautious.
Oh. Now it's my chance to frown. I'm sorry, I wasn't trying to be critical. I just noticed.
No, I know, he says. It's fine. Promise.
After a beat, I say, so I should probably stop leaving you big-ass croissants. He smiles at me. It's kind of a rusty expression, but it still makes my heart flutter victoriously.
No, he assures me. Just so long as you're not offended if I give some of them to Margaret.
I faux gasp. Uh-oh, Hayden. Looks like someone has to put a quarter in the M-word jar. He rolls his eyes.
I'm not talking about work, he says. I just acknowledged her existence. That's not breaking any rules.
Maybe none of yours, I say. A smirk pulls at his wide mouth.
Okay, fine.
He digs around in his jeans pocket and puts a handful of coins on the table. Not going to ask why you actually have quarters on hand, I say, sliding two toward me. Just going to assume you and whoever you currently work for are spending a lot of time at arcades.
That's your prerogative, he says.
I slip the quarters into the tabletop jukebox and flip until I find a winner. No one else in the place seems to be queuing up songs, because as soon as the 50s rockabilly number playing over the speakers ends, Say You Will Be Mine by Cosmo Sinclair starts playing.
Oh, come on, he says on a huff of laughter. How is this not breaking a rule?
What are you talking about? I say. This song is a classic.
And you know who he wrote this for?
He asks. I grin and slide my forearms across the table until they meet his. No. Who? He studies me as he works out his next play. I don't back down either, holding his gaze fast. The challenge building between us is starting to tip over into something else, a heat in his eyes, a pull in the center of my chest.
Here you folks go.
The server plops our plates down beside us, really plops them, like probably gets them no closer than 3 inches from the tabletop before letting go. We jolt apart and take a beat to study our respective plates before tucking in. What do you think? I ask him after a couple of bites.
Should have gone with the $6 steak, he says.
I choke on a laugh, lean forward, and drop my voice. Yeah, I'd say this round goes to Ray's. He picks up his cup of sweet tea.
To Ray.
I straighten up and tap my mug against it. To Ray, I say. And to whoever inspired this song, because it's absolutely undeniable.
To her too,
he says with a nod. 17. We wander the quaint streets of Savannah, past old stone buildings and Greek Revival homes with porches stacked up 3 levels, live oak sweeping low and draped in Spanish moss. It's late, but we're not alone. Pockets of revelers spill out of a red brick bar on the corner, and a woman on the steps of a brownstone across the street smokes a cigarette while talking on the phone, the humidity muffling their voices, nature soundproofing.
It's almost like New York, Hayden says. Parts of it, anyway.
Rich parts, I say.
True,
he muses. Do you think you'll stay there forever? I ask. He blows out a breath.
I don't know. I like it, a lot. But I grew up with a yard, with woods behind my house. If I had kids, I'd want that for them, I think.
Do you want to have kids? I ask.
Sometimes, he says. When I'm feeling optimistic.
I bump sideways into him, the skin of our arms sticking slightly from the heat. Does that happen often? He looks down his shoulder at me with a slight smirk.
Not often, no.
So the rest of the time, I say, when you're not feeling optimistic, what do you think?
The rest of the time...
Another long exhale, his eyes straight ahead as we go back to ambling down the block.
The rest of the time, I think, what if the polar ice caps keep melting? What if medical care keeps getting more expensive and Social Security runs out and housing prices keep rising while minimum wage doesn't? And what if they resent me for bringing them into all of this? What if they just hate me? Not because of the state of the world, but just because they hate me. Or what if they're sick? What if they join a cult and I can't convince them to come home? What if they start a cult? What if they get into some heinous shit and I can't love them anymore? Or worse, I keep loving them even though I can't change anything. What if there's another world war? Or what if everything else goes right, but at the end of my life, they're sitting in hospice with me?
His voice thickens uncharacteristically, wavering just the slightest bit.
And there are things they wish they could say to me, or hear from me, but I don't remember who I am, let alone who they are. What if they have to care for me for years after I've stopped calling them by their nicknames or telling them I love them?
I stop walking, a cold weight pressing against my chest, and he does too, but he doesn't face me.
I wasn't sure. I wanted to do another book,
he says finally, his voice a rattle.
It's hard, spending years with a person. Especially someone at the tail end of life. The same thing I love about this job is what I hate about it.
What's that?
It feels like you've lived their whole life with them,
he says.
And I just can't help but think, we're not supposed to know how it all ends this early. It's too much of a burden.
I slide my hand into his fingers rigid at first, then relaxing into my grip. Is that all? I say softly. His eyes drop on a smile, then climb back to mine.
Yep, that's it.
I squeeze his hand tight enough that I can feel his pulse, or maybe it's just mine, amplified by the contact, the pressure, the heat. Maybe, I say slowly, it's a burden, but it's also a gift. Life is so complicated. And I think it's human nature to try to untangle those complications. We want everything to make sense. And that's okay, it's a worthy pursuit. But back when my sister wasn't well, when every day felt uncertain, I searched for the words. His forehead creases, his tone so hopeful it nearly breaks my heart.
You understood how much each one was worth?
I understood what really mattered. I offer. I understood my priorities. I understood what in this life was non-negotiable for me. A lot of people don't find that out until it's too late. They wait to say things and they don't get the chance. So collecting other people's stories, learning from their mistakes, it is a gift too. You are who you are right now in part because of what you did for Len and his family. You can't control any of that other stuff you worry about. But you can control what you do. He gazes down at me, his expression vulnerable, his usually severe features somehow diffused in the streetlight.
I don't know anyone like you, he says.
I don't know anyone like you, I tell him.
I'm serious,
he says, voice hushed. So am I reply. He lifts our interlaced fingers between us, studying them with a divot between his brows. After a long pause, he lifts my hand higher, pressing his lips against the back of it. It's such a tender gesture, so careful and light, but it makes my heart speed and my throat tighten. When his eyes rise to mine, it feels like the world has tilted just slightly on its axis. Like this is the first time I've ever felt the full weight of his gaze, and I can hardly breathe, and I want to say something or do something, but I'm not sure what I can say, can do, where the delicate, invisible boundary between us lies. So I do what he did. I bring his hand up to my lips, my eyes falling closed as I press a kiss to his skin, smell his almond soap, and taste the salt of his sweat on the tip of my tongue. I feel his forehead bow to press against my shoulder, his free hand coming up to gently cradle the back of my neck as we stand there together on the walk in a puddle of light. When I open my eyes and let go of his hand, He snakes it around my waist too, crushing me to his chest, my cheek to his collarbone, my arms winding tight around his hips. A hug that's more than a hug, that stretches out indefinitely, our breathing heavy and our bodies hot everywhere they're touching. I think we must have both decided the same thing, that nothing else can happen between us, and I think that just makes both of us all the less willing to stop. I feel him growing hard, and an ache begins in my thighs, my nipples peeking against his chest. He lets out a soft hum against my ear, one of his hands running a trail up and down my spine as he buries his mouth softly in my neck. Not a kiss, just an incidental touch of his parted lips to my skin. Just his breath there on that sensitive place between my throat and my shoulder is enough to unspool something deep in me. I arch a little, and he squeezes me tighter, molds me to him. I let my hands climb into his hair, twist my face into his neck the way he did to mine, taking every bit of him he'll allow. He touched my hair, so I touch his. He dragged his mouth along my throat, so I let mine trail over his. He tries to pull me closer again, as if there's any room at all left between us. There's not, other than the one unbreachable divide, the job. And I can't help myself any longer. I take just a little more, the smallest bit, a flick of my tongue against his skin, and he groans into me, my body shivering with the sound. The ache in me deepens. I tell myself not to roll my hips against his, but it happens anyway, and his breath hisses at my neck, his hands clenching.
I have to stop,
he murmurs roughly. We're not doing anything, I whimper back. He grinds against me, just for a second, but it's enough to send sparks all through my body, flickers of color across my vision, a harsh gasp between my lips. He grips my hips, pushing me slowly away from him, almost like we're peeling apart, like there's resistance there, trying to keep us close, the memory of that friction still hanging around me like an afterglow. Stone cold sober, and he looks almost as drunk as I feel, his eyes abyss dark and face fraught with unspent tension.
Can I walk you back to your car?
He says softly. I nod, still too unsteady to speak. Nothing happened, I'll remind myself later, while I'm lying awake, eyes turned up to the stucco ceiling. It was just a hug. My body will tell a very different story. Yours, mine, and the truth. I spend Friday morning back down on the beach, watching the sunrise and then wading into the water and floating on my back. Afterward, I send pictures to the group text between Mom, Audrey, and Dad's old number. Someday, I know it will be reassigned to someone new, and we'll have to take him off the chat, but so far, none of us has. Audrey, probably because she's too busy to care about that kind of thing, but Mom's a little more of a mystery. As much as she and Dad loved each other, I still would have assumed her no-nonsense attitude would preclude anything so sentimental as keeping her late husband on a text thread. Then again, it's just as likely that she doesn't know how to remove it and can't be bothered to start a new chain. She and Audrey are similar that way. Not Luddites exactly, but far from tech savvy. I send them some shots of the sunrise earlier and the water now, the tourists teeming across the sand with babies in floppy sun hats and raucous preteens carting foam boogie boards behind them. Not a bad office for the day, I say. Mom chimes in quickly. LOL. She's at least savvy enough to use abbreviations that have been around for multiple decades, I'll give her that. She follows it up with another message. Must be nice. I don't think she means it as a dig. It feels like one. Audrey replies with a selfie of her and a local farmer planting fruit trees in a community garden. Please take a nice long dip in my honor, Audrey writes. We should come here on your next trip home, I say, and she writes that she'd love that. Then Mom asks how the garden is going, and the conversation moves on. And in a way, it's a relief to not have to worry that Mom's disappointment in me might bubble up any further, spill over from unsaid to said. Audrey talks about work, Mom talks about her chickens. They both look forward to Christmas the next time Audrey will be in Georgia for a few weeks, and I sit on my towel, the sand warming beneath it, and miss my father and the world when he was still in it. When this conversation would have at least one other person who was, as Mom used to lovingly call him, fanciful. The beach pictures would have almost certainly elicited a reference to a song about nature's beauty, maybe even a Cosmo Sinclair original, or else a shot of our composting outhouse with a caption about it being his office most days. Potty humor, dad jokes, old music, and deep laughter. Those are the holes he left behind in our family unit. The texts peter off, and I fish my notebook out of my bag, popping in my earbuds and queuing up the rest of yesterday's recording. I want to transcribe everything later, but for now, I just want to let Margaret's story wash over me again, see what jumps out, and jot down timestamps. This interview felt so different. Before, she'd been recounting her family's oral history. Now we've reached the part where, as she put it, all of the characters were real to her. People she loved, people she'd fought with, people she'd lost. She started with her father and mother's friendship. Freddie Ives had sent Doris Bernie Bernhardt a bouquet to celebrate her new contract with MGM, and they hadn't spoken again until her first MGM film released. He'd gone to see it opening night, sat by himself in the fourth row, dead center at Grauman's Chinese Theater. The following Monday, she'd walked into her office to find another bouquet and a card. Realism be damned, you're going places. X. F. Ives. She called Freddie to thank him, though she pretended to think his name was Fives, and he went along with it. They wound up on the phone for an hour and a half, mostly talking about the film, but a little about other things, too. He updated her on Royal Pictures' inner office drama, who was sleeping with whom, who had found out about it, which A-list actor had most recently shown up to set, still wasted from the night before, and thrown up on a camera while it was filming. She was surprised by his sense of humor, and when she told him as much, he became uncommonly serious. "You shouldn't be," he told her. "I was born into a life where I needn't take anything seriously if I don't want to." "But don't you want to?" she asked. And then he had a turn at being surprised, because he found he did. He took her seriously. He took her work seriously. By then, he'd seen all of her pictures a number of times, mostly from a position of curiosity. Now that he knew they'd been directed by a woman, would he be able to tell? Was it different? He hadn't come to a concrete conclusion other than this. Every time he watched one of her films, he noticed something new. And this made him better at his job, if only marginally. The next week, he called her again. The same A-list star had knocked over a full wall in the studio while filming. "Most of his pay is going to his insurance by now," he said. They laughed about it together, but it wasn't entirely funny. Bernie had been let go after overperforming. This man was knocking down walls and still under contract. He was the face, the reason people went to the movies. In Royal Pictures' estimation, they needed him, whereas Bernie needed them. Realism. Freddie knew this, felt it in the long pause after their laughter died down, and wanted to say something about it, but couldn't seem to find the right words. So instead, he asked her if she'd like to go for a walk sometime, and she said yes, and it became a tradition. A weekly walk. He dated other women. She dated not at all. They had hardly even touched when finally, after 11 months of weekly walks and tri-weekly phone calls, he had stopped abruptly with an idea, a bolt of lightning, looked her in the eye and said, "Bernie, I think we should get married." And she'd laughed because it was ridiculous, but eventually she realized he was serious. "Why?" she said. "Because you're my favorite person in the world," he said. "And talking to you three times a week isn't enough, at least for me. So would you consider it?" And she said, "Don't you want to kiss me first?" He said, "Of course I do, but I thought I'd better see whether you were amenable to the idea first, or you might slap me." She told him she would have. And then she stepped forward, set her hands on his face, and kissed him. It wasn't fireworks, according to either of them. It was more like slipping into a warm bath. They were engaged for a few months with no real rush to the altar until Bernie missed a period and it became obvious it was time to scramble. The ceremony was small, just a few friends and family, all of them shocked the union had made it to the finish line, the derelict playboy and the shrewd lady director. They made no sense to anyone except themselves, and later, once Bernie had gotten to know her a bit better, to Freddie's sister, Francine. But it worked. Bernie moved into Freddie's wing of the House of Ives. She attended his mother's charity auctions, and she joined their awkward thrice-weekly family dinners. She played in the family's expansive orange groves with her husband's 7-year-old cousin, Ruth, and even came around to calling her LP, the little princess, like only family members did. In 1938, their daughter came, screaming like a banshee into the world, as was the Ives tradition, at a hospital whose entire upper floor had been cleared for the family. They named her Margaret Grace Ives, after Bernie's late mother, and by the time they left the hospital, Photoplay had already published her name. Normally, the fan magazine only concerned itself with actors, but Freddie was handsome and charismatic, and Bernie was something of a novelty, so they'd reached a certain level of celebrity, which their daughter inherited, along with everything else that came with being an Ives. For the first 2 months of Margaret's life, her father rarely left her or her mother's side, but eventually, he had to get back to work. Bernie missed directing, missed being at the studio every single day. But she also missed her daughter every time she fell asleep. She wondered how she would survive having her soul split like that. She knew for certain she could never be fully contented again as long as she lived. Half of her would always be elsewhere. 3 years later, Laura Rose Ives was born, and she was Margaret's polar opposite. As a newborn, Margaret would wail and cry every time she wanted anything, and so she and Bernie quickly developed an unspoken language. At 4 months old, before Margaret could crawl, she was already trying to figure out how to stand up. Laura was a quiet little blob, watchful, curious, but not demanding. Margaret had her mother's sandy hair and her father's tan skin, whereas Laura had her father's thick black waves and her mother's creamy complexion. As the girls grew, Laura was cautious, careful, a little shadow trailing down the long marble hallways after her reckless older sister. Bernie worried about her. She worried about both of them, for different reasons. She waited until Margaret turned 5 and Laura was 2 before broaching the subject of going back to work. Late one night, as she and Freddie lay curled together beneath the deep blue and gold canopy of their bed, their reading lamps still on. He asked if she was sure. "Won't you miss them?" "Of course I will," she said. "Don't you?" And that settled it. He knew he couldn't keep her cooped up there, half of her nurtured while the other went bone dry. It took several months for her to get a new contract. Freddie, of course, wanted her to come back to Royal, but she'd wound up at Universal instead. At first, they met for walks twice a week, but she was making up for lost time, which meant working more, working harder. That was when the fighting between Margaret's parents had begun. It was also where we left off for the day. The recording ends and I pull my earbuds out, set my phone and notebook aside, watching a young family building a sandcastle just out of reach of the tide, digging a moat all around it so that when the water finally does rise, it won't knock the whole thing over. I mean, probably it will, but at least they'll know they tried. Once, years ago, when I was in college and taking an entry-level writing class, I interviewed my dad as part of an assignment. He told me about growing up in Oklahoma and about seeing the ocean for the first time when he moved out to California, where he and my mother had met when they were just out of college. I wish I'd recorded that whole conversation. I didn't. But I took notes, and I wrote the paper, and a couple of things stuck in my memory clear and sharp. When he saw the ocean for the first time, he said it terrified him, made him dizzy and almost nauseated and just truly, deeply afraid that anything could be that big, that powerful, that natural and uncontrollable, something society couldn't take credit for and could never fully tame either. He told me he'd only ever felt that way 2 other times in his life. "When your sister was born," he said, "and then you." Gee, thanks, Dad. That's great to hear, I replied, and he grinned. He was a grinner, like me. You're supposed to be learning to write nonfiction, right? I've got to tell you the truth. Those were the three times in my life I felt true wonder, and it was so much to take in, it felt like my body might spiderweb with cracks, honestly. And then I was happy, too, if I didn't mention that. You sure didn't, I said. I was getting to it, he joked. But it wasn't the first feeling. The first feeling was, holy shit, this is a whole person. How is that even possible? He didn't swear a lot because Mom didn't like swearing, but sometimes when it was the two of us, he'd throw in a good shit or hell for emphasis. Why didn't I record him? I think again, with a deep pulse of pain. And just as fast, I feel a breeze ripple over my back, and it's hard not to believe, or maybe just hope, that maybe I didn't need to record it. That maybe he's here, his atoms redistributed, the ashes we sprinkled in the river near our house now mixed with the sand all around me, his love permanent and intractable as ever. Love isn't something you can cup in your hands, and I have to believe that means it's something that can't ever be lost. I grab my phone again and open a text thread I've let sit empty for 2 years now, the one with just Dad's number. I want to say the perfect thing in this missive to no one, but even with all the time in the world, I can't find the words. The closest I get is a two-word message. Thank you. Right after I send it, my phone vibrates and I almost choke on my tongue. But, perhaps obviously, it's not my dad texting me back. It's a one-word message, and for some reason, it really does feel like the perfect message. Hello, Hayden writes. Hello, I write back. What are you doing tonight? 18. Old Moe's Sugar House is a hit from the beginning. For one thing, the entire exterior is painted in three separate shades of frosting pink. It's a little grungy from the passing of time, but still looks like the setting of my childhood dreams. It's the same kind of fare as Ray's or the Atomic Cafe, and the same kind of no-nonsense service. If you were out of touch enough to ask for a latte here, I'm sure you'd be the proud recipient of a nice bless your heart from the staff. When our server drops off our dangerously hot plates, I catch Hayden's gaze traveling straight past his steel-cut oatmeal to my gravy-doused biscuits and short stack of pancakes. You look like a wistful war bride right now, I tease him, watching at the window for your baby to come home.
What?
He looks up abruptly, blinking clear of his biscuit haze. Would you like a bite? I offer.
No, he says. That's okay.
Are you sure? I ask. I really don't mind. I push the bowl of biscuits toward him.
Maybe just a bite,
he says, and retrieves his silverware, neatly cutting a small hunk from one of the biscuits, swooping it over his plate, and popping it between his lips. His eyes go glassy. He makes a little hum in his throat. I lean forward and scoop the rest of the biscuit he cut into onto his plate.
Wow.
He says, finally. Good? I ask.
Very,
he says. You know what I bet would make it better? I ask.
What?
Pink food coloring, I say, sawing into my pancakes. He snorts.
I don't think that has a taste.
Maybe not, but it would have an impact. I'd feel the pink. He grins crookedly, and my heart leaps.
You'd feel it. What does pink feel like?
I think for a moment. I think it's like the giddy part of a sunrise.
The giddy part of a sunrise,
he repeats. Yeah, you know how sunrise mostly just makes you feel like awed or moved, like it feels profound?
No,
he says. Well, for me it does, I say. But there's a moment when everything's just all pink, pink lemonade pink, and it feels almost silly, like the sky is playing. It's a color that I'm shocked can be in nature, but since it can be, I really see no reason why it couldn't also be in biscuits. He laughs, shakes his head to himself as he stuffs another bite of biscuit into his mouth. What? I say.
I've never once thought the sky seemed like it was playing.
I shrug and sip on my coffee. You think I'm being ridiculous? I say, half statement, half question.
I think you live in a world that's more interesting than the one most people live in,
he says. And just as my heart starts to sink with disappointment, with a kind of loneliness, he adds,
and I wish I could live in it too.
I feel myself beaming. I'll take you sometime.
I'd like that,
he says. After breakfast for dinner, it's clear neither of us wants to go home yet, but it's just as clear that neither of us is going to suggest going back to my house. We can be friendly, if not merely professional, as long as we're somewhere public. We walk for a while around old Moe's, but there's nothing cute or quaint here. We're trapped back in an industrial complex much newer than the diner. When we get to our cars, I say, I know what we should do now. And his expression is so dubious, I can only assume he's bracing himself for a pitch that we chug a vat of pink food dye and have sex in his car. I step away from him toward my own rental parked two spots over. Follow me, I call, unlocking the car. He doesn't ask any questions, just nods. I remember the day he hesitated to shake my hand at Margaret's house, and the change from then to now makes me go so warm I have to blast the air conditioning on the ride over. Hayden follows me through the dark, up the wooden platform, through the grassy dunes, to the beach proper. Are you sick of the beach by now? I ask, given that we're only a half block from the Grand Lucia here.
I haven't really been, he says. I'm not a huge beach person.
I slant a look at him. It's hard to be a beach person when you're not a shorts person.
Good point. Fuck shit!
He lurches sideways on the platform, grabbing me bodily and hauling me against the railing. What? What? I yelp, eyes skittering around the path ahead of us. A tail slithers over the side of the walkway, disappearing into the dunes. It's just a little snake, I say, trying to be soothing.
I hate snakes,
he says. I thought you grew up playing in the woods, I say.
I did, he says. And every time we came across a snake, I had to completely disassociate and pretend it wasn't happening so the kids I was hanging out with wouldn't find out.
I start forward again, and his arms come around my waist, pulling me back toward him. It's fine, I say, wiggling out of his grip. It's gone.
It might just be waiting to strike right over the edge,
he says. It's not, I tell him.
How could you possibly know that?
He says. I know, I insist. Can't you disassociate and pretend that didn't just happen? He shakes his head.
It won't work. I'm not afraid of humiliating myself in front of you.
I feign offense.
I just mean, I can't imagine you making fun of me for it.
A smile uncurls over my lips. Well, I'm willing to try if that helps.
Your heart won't be in it,
he says.
It won't work.
Well, we're almost to the water, I point out. Let's just run.
You're wearing a skirt,
he says. I'm sure I have a full-blown Cheshire Cat grin now. Are you worried for my virtue here?
I'm worried for your ankles, he clarifies. I don't want you getting bitten.
I won't get bitten, I promise, and start forward again.
No, no, no.
He hurries after me, bending and sweeping me off my feet and into his arms. My yelp of surprise becomes a breathless laugh as he essentially runs past where the snake disappeared, as close to the opposite railing as possible, then moves back to the dead center of the walkway. I try to tell him he can put me down, that he doesn't have to do this, but I'm laughing too hard. As we reach the beach, he slows, the grass and any hidden reptiles now in the rear view. I can't believe you risked your ankles for me, I tease, the moon glowing behind Hayden's head.
I'm wearing pants,
he reminds me. I wouldn't have blamed you if I'd gotten bitten, I say.
I would have blamed me.
He comes to a stop and bends a little to pour me back onto my feet. His forearm brushes up my thighs in an electrically charged way, slipping under my skirt in the process and leaving me shivering and weak-kneed by the time my feet meet sand.
Sorry,
he says thickly, reaching out to pull my skirt back into place, and the light tug of his hands on the fabric doesn't have the cooling effect I'd guess he's hoping for. Instead,
We wind up standing chest to chest, the dark humming around us, like we're two tuning forks vibrating in resonance. I start to panic, because the more this happens, the more we find ourselves acting like something other than friends, the less likely that I think it is he'll keep being my friend. And even though it's only been a couple of weeks, I would miss him.
"Should we go down to the water?"
I ask a little too loudly and turn on my heel to start trekking that way without even checking that he's following. He is, of course, and with his long strides, he comes even with me almost instantly. We stop just before we reach the edge of the ocean and sit, our legs stretched out across the sand, eyes on the dark horizon.
"What's your life like?"
I say.
"Back in New York."
He looks over at me.
"What do you mean?"
"I just only know you in this bubble," I say. "It's kind of strange."
He thinks for a minute.
"Well, I work a lot."
His eyes flick back to mine.
"As I'm sure you do."
I nod.
"I'm busy all the time,"
he says.
"Do you like it?" I ask.
His head cocks to one side, his lips parting.
"I like being busy with work,"
he says.
"But sometimes the pace gets to me. Or maybe it doesn't, but then I come someplace like this and..."
He holds an arm out toward the ocean.
"It's nice, right?" I say.
"I used to think I'd get so bored if I lived anywhere else,"
he says.
"Which is weird because I actually loved growing up in the middle of nowhere, other than the whole mayor's family under the microscope thing."
"Me too," I say. "I mean, small towns definitely have their drawbacks, especially when it comes to gossip. But I love the pace here."
"And LA?"
he says.
"I love it there too," I say. "I mean, the food's great and it's sunny every single day, and I've got a good group of friends there."
"Did you always want to end up there?"
he asks.
"I did," I admit. "I started writing to deal with the stuff going on with Audrey, and then, unrelated, I was always obsessed with Hollywood. I loved magazines, but my parents would never spend money on them, so I'd literally just sit in the aisle of the grocery store and read about clothes and beauty trends and celebrities. My mom was always so annoyed when she found me. She'd have been waiting for me at the checkout for a while, and I'd still have to go put the magazines back."
"Well, at least you were polite enough to reshelve,"
he says diplomatically.
"Oh, you've got to reshelve," I agree.
"What about you? Was New York your dream?"
"I didn't really have a dream,"
he says.
"If anything, I think I assumed I'd be a mechanic because my best friend's dad was one, so we were constantly working on his shitty VW van. But my parents really, really pushed college, and then I got into Purdue, which was a shock because I only really did well in school the last 2 years. And then I got into writing my freshman year and stuck with it. Got an internship in Chicago after graduation, and that turned into a staff writer job. I didn't really plan on ever leaving, but a better job came up in New York, and I'd just gone through a breakup, so I figured it might be good to get away for a while. My best friend from college lives there too, so that's been nice, watching him get married and have a kid."
I beam at him. "Are you Uncle Hayden?"
"Of course not,"
he says sternly.
"I'm Uncle Nada."
I let my head settle against his shoulder as the laugh ripples through me.
"Oh, excuse me," I say. "I should have guessed."
His chin tips down and he smiles, his mouth so close to mine, his eyes soft. After just a second too long, he says,
"Do you ever come to New York?"
"A few times a year," I say. "What about you? Are you ever in LA?"
"Not often,"
he says. I nod. We go on staring into each other's eyes until it feels like I can't any longer, not without brushing my mouth up over his full bottom lip, tasting him, feeling the heat of his tongue. I pull away and lie back, staring at the sky and waiting to catch my breath.
"What happened with your ex?"
I ask, and this is a far more successful dousing of the mounting ember between us. His brow rumples as he gazes over his shoulder toward me.
"The one in Chicago," I say, "before you went to New York."
"Ah."
He turns back toward the water.
"Piper."
"Piper," I accidentally repeat aloud and hope he can't hear the mix of desperate curiosity and hopefully subtle jealousy in my voice. What happened with her? He clears his throat and takes a beat before answering.
We worked together. I mean, we were already dating before she started working there, since college. But we'd been working together for 2 years when we applied for the same promotion.
Oh, shit, I say. Did you know? He looks back, a completely unconvincing smile on his lips. The expression, though small, makes him look a little feral.
It was my idea. I was applying, but I thought she might as well too. And then I got it, and things fell apart between us really fast. So I found a different job, quit that one, thinking they'd promote her instead, and we could, I don't know, go back to how things were. But instead they promoted someone else, who had started there 4 months before her, and everything got worse.
I'm so sorry, I say. That sounds horrible.
It was years ago now, he says. But honestly, it was the last serious relationship I was in.
Really? I say. His head cocks to the left.
I find it hard to believe that's surprising.
Well, it's even harder picturing you casually dating, I say.
I don't much,
he says.
Just feels like work.
Do you get lonely? I meant it in the most innocent way possible, but as soon as it sneaks out, I tingle with embarrassment. But he just studies me seriously, like it's a perfectly normal thing to ask someone you very clearly want to sleep with.
Sometimes I...
He hesitates. You can tell me, I say, almost a whisper. His jaw muscles leap.
Sometimes I just miss this. Being close to someone. Being touched. Not just sex, I mean.
The tingle on my skin turns inward, my veins whirring eagerly now. I pat the sand beside me meaningfully. He doesn't move for so long that I've already accepted he's not going to join me by the time he finally does lie back, his long body rigid and hyper-aware. Slowly, watching his face for a reaction, for any sign that it's too much, I shift closer to him. Rest my head in the divot just inside his shoulder. I set one hand on his chest, and it expands with a deep breath, the muscles down his flank seeming to relax between us. He sets one hand over mine, dwarfing it, and even though we'd already been touching so many places, incidentally, this purposeful contact makes me pleasantly shiver. His eyes flutter closed, his dark lashes kissing the tops of his cheeks.
I love this,
he rasps after a second in a rush, like the thought went straight from his brain to his lips, and judging from the way he tenses as soon as he said it, I think that might be exactly what happened. I do too, I whisper back, and this soothes him. I let myself wiggle closer, his other arm sneaking under my back to curl around me. I move a little, restless, and he squeezes my hand under his as he shifts too, turning onto his side, our arms and limbs rearranging until I'm on mine too, the medium spoon to his big one. I can feel his heartbeat against my shoulder blade, and now his hand is draped over my stomach, lightly atop one of my own. I take a deep breath just for the excuse to feel more of the wall of him behind me. I love this, I admit, nestling back into him.
Me too,
he whispers right beneath my ear. He's hard against my back, and I will myself not to move around too much, but it's an effort. I feel antsy, exhilarated. His next warm breath makes me bow, and his hand folds over the top of mine, not touching me himself, but touching me all the same. He moves my hand up higher, brings it fully over my chest with a groan into my ear. I push myself back against him, and he skims higher, reaching the neckline of my shirt, letting me pull it down myself, his warm breath feathering down to dance along my bare skin. His hand tightens around mine, gripping me without gripping me. I press back, trying to find the friction between us, and he takes the opportunity to guide my hand lower, pulling the neckline down until my left breast is exposed to the moonlight.
God, Alice,
he hisses.
We'd be so good together.
I whimper as he sets my hand where he wants it, catches my nipples between my own fingers. I want to, I whisper.
Not now,
he says.
If you still want to after all of this.
He trails off as his lips brush the side of my throat, not quite kissing, just teasing. He drags my hand down my center all the way to my skirt. I squirm at the pressure between my thighs, but he keeps moving until he reaches the hem and then guides my hand beneath the fabric, settling my palm against myself. I grind myself back against him, and he gently cups me over my hand. He swears, thrusts behind me, and the sensation shoots through my bloodstream like firecrackers.
We were just supposed to touch,
he murmurs. Then touch me, Hayden, I say. His hand releases from mine and slides up over my chest, tight, kneading. I bite down on a cry as he pushes the fabric down again, and I arch back, desperate for his mouth to touch my bare skin. Instead, he buries it safely in my hair and does what I asked. Touches me, drags a thumb roughly over my nipple, then catches it between his pointer and middle fingers on a groan. I turn hungrily toward him, reach for his belt. He catches my wrist, stilling me.
I'm touching you, remember?
He says, gently removing my hand from the buckle. He sets it on the side of his neck, then slips his hand between my thighs. I gasp at the smooth glide of his fingers over me, my legs parting. His eyes watch me drunkenly, and as I move myself against him, he swallows hard, gravels.
You're so wet.
I know, I whisper. He buries his face in my neck again, a frustrated groan vibrating through him as he slides his hand down the inside of my thigh, as if with great effort.
What are you doing tomorrow night?
He says finally. Surprise pulls a shallow, breathy laugh out of me.
Why? Because I think we should go out,
he says.
Somewhere with a lot of people and very bright lights.
I'd personally rather be somewhere warm, dark, cozy, and private. I can't. He stills for a second, then nods, his expression seeming to zip up, going from raw and intimate to cool and almost businesslike, despite the very unbusinesslike position we're lying in.
Of course,
he says, as if he expected this, as if he's the one who crossed the line when it was, as always, me. No, Hayden. I grab his hand and pull it in between us. I mean, I can't. I'm going down to see my mom tomorrow.
Oh.
His brows flinch upward in surprise, then slowly settle into a furrow.
Is that stressful for you?
No, not really, I say. It's only partly a lie. Partly in that it is definitely stressful, but it's also nice and fun and everything else at intervals.
It'll be lonely here without you,
he says matter-of-factly, and I try not to melt into the sand where the goop of my former body would never be entirely recovered. You could come with me, I say. At the way he startles, I hurry to add, not like, come meet my mom. Just like she's always happy to have guests. And her house isn't exceptionally bright, but it's not private because she's there. Plus a bunch of chickens and... never mind. Just an idea.
Wouldn't that be weird?
He asks, gaze narrowing.
I mean, how would we explain what...
He trails off, apparently unwilling to say the mortifying phrase, what we are, or the equally damning, what's going on between us. But I meant what I said. My mom's an amazing host, actually. It's one of her passions. I've brought home a lot of friends over the years. She'd love to have you. He thinks it over. No pressure. I sit up, a more respectable distance between us. Just if you wanted to get out of town. He does the same, still silent, face serious and eyes watchful on the waves. My cheeks start burning.
I don't want you to invite me to be polite,
he says suddenly. My gaze snaps toward him. I'm not, I promise. And I really don't want you to say yes to be polite.
You forget,
he says.
I never do anything to be polite.
At my laugh, he reaches out and gently touches my lips, light and fleeting.
I'd love to go.
I beam back at him. Good. And then, quickly, almost like he didn't mean to at all,